It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
The sublet I'm staying in New York has a Peloton bike, and I use it like every morning but of course.
Really?
I love it. It's amazing. Well, it's like the classes. Basically, if you don't know what a Peloton bike is, it's like a spin bike. Like it's like a stationary bike, but attached to it is like an iPad at the front. And the iPad has all these classes on it. And so you have like a teacher built into your thing. Like it's basically like your own virtual spin class.
Right. I feel like I have heard about this. Pelotons are such a foreign land to me.
They're so fascinating. The teachers are known for being kind of flirty, like, but it's not live, like it's all recorded. But I've even noticed this where like it's like all these like hot British people and they're on their bikes and they're really peppy, and then like sometimes the camera angle will change and they like look at the second camera angle and they just give you this look and you're like, are we about to kiss? Like,
that's so crazy.
What's going on? And my one favorite guy, Bradley Rose, he's like this white dude like he's just like a funny silly guy. I don't know, and I kind of like his classes. They're challenging, but they don't feel like painful or anything. And today in the class I was using, like, I don't know when these are recorded, right? So I have no idea what's going on. At one point, he literally goes, and then you just got to do the old hawk to a twizzle on that thing.
Oh my God. Okay. So
I was like, stop.
They have them in the studio weekly. That's crazy.
Yeah. They got their list of memes on like a whiteboard behind the camera. They're like, you gotta hit
next
one
week.
Of these.
He's gonna be commenting on the election or something.
Oh my God, imagine he makes like a Kamala coconut joke.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
Do you think people have parasocial relationships with their Peloton instructors?
1,000%. Like, he has me laughing and like blushing sometimes. Like, I'm like,
look for him on Raya. I bet he's on Raya.
Bradley Rose. Yeah. I just love the name Bradley Rose. So funny.
That can't be real. That cannot be a real name.
He's so funny. Peloton is the weirdest phenomenon. I don't fully understand it. Like, I have some friends who just do Peloton or like have subscriptions to it, but I feel like the bike is like heavy duty.
And that's how Mr. Big died. Spoiler.
And famously, that's how Mr. Big dies. And
just
I think
like
about
Mr. Big was dead. Or whatever.
Just like that, he died. What does she say after he died? She says something. She says exactly that.
Yeah, that's how the show, like, that's the first "and just like that," I think. She goes, "and just like that, Mr. Big was dead."
I think she goes, "and just like that, everything had changed," or something, which is fair.
Well, that's a bit more classy than Mr. Big is dead, but yeah.
Hannah and I actually did, like, reviews of "and just like that" on my YouTube Patreon when it had come out, and I feel like they're pretty good, so...
I had to abandon ship with "and just like that." I'm sorry, everyone.
I thought you liked the last season. Oh, that was me.
I watched the first episode and I was like, I can't do it. Miranda and Che are in LA.
It's better. It gets better.
I can't do it.
I'm tolerating it. I was pretty against it, but the last season was okay. It's okay. My main thing is just like, I thought Big dying was such a cop out because I feel like it was copping out of writing their marriage, and like I would love to see an older couple in like these older stages of their marriages, what their sex life is like, that kind of thing. And I feel like they just kind of like wrote that out. And I understand she's supposed to have this like single essence, but I don't know. I would have liked to see like an older couple.
I think the thing with Sex and the City is that there was almost never a moment where she and Big were just in domestic bliss, and I don't think they ever knew how to write it. I think he's such a one-dimensional character for the most part that, like, even in the movies, when they're supposed to be together, they found ways to keep them apart.
I don't think he's one-dimensional, but I do think a lot of the draw of him is that he's elusive.
Well, that's what I mean. There's not, like, a lot to
show. I think he's a bit complicated, but I know.
Breaking up Miranda and Steve, too. I'm like, that's a couple you actually did know how to write. So it's like, yeah.
I can't. Yeah. And I know someone needs to be single on the show. Like, I get it. And if Samantha's not there anymore, then it's like you need. But I don't know. I think it felt a bit boring. And even in the movies, they're never together. Like, second movie, she goes to freaking, oh my God, Abu Dhabi. They go on their trip and you just don't get to see Big the entire movie. Same as the first movie, they break up.
Yeah, the first movie, like, he leaves her at the altar.
Yeah. So yeah, Peloton. All the cycles of life can happen on a Peloton. I feel like today I was rebirthed when that guy told me to twizzle on that thing.
Do you think anyone has ever been conceived on a Peloton?
Conceived on a Peloton?
I don't know.
Like, immaculately?
Well,
like,
the cycle of life. No, I don't know.
Immaculately conceived between, like, between the instructor and me on my bike.
What if, what's his name? John Rose? Bradley Rose.
Bradley Rose has, like, sired thousands of children all around the world just with his eyes. Just with that look he gives you on the second camera. Sorry to objectify you, Bradley Rose. He's a great teacher.
Good. What if he's a listener? Shout out.
But also, like, he told me to twizzle on that thing, so I'm like...
That's what I'm saying. I don't know.
I'm Maya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about when art meets the internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. Our bonus episodes for this season will be coming out once the season concludes. And if you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. So this episode is called Balletcore, but I'm using the term balletcore here not specifically with regards to the current fashion trend, although, like, we will talk about that. Instead, balletcore here, I wanted to refer to what, like, I'm perceiving to be the internet creating the cyclical dynamic between pop culture and the world of dance, where it feels like the more traditionalistic and sometimes even, like, abusive practices on the most extreme end of dance seem to be influencing our wider culture, and vice versa. Like, it's hard to tell what is influencing what. So with that in mind, I want to guide our discussion today with the question, are we living in a time of balletcore? This really is what it is to be, like, an internet person, is to say a sentence like that and use that as, like, the guiding sentence of an hour-long podcast episode, but here we are. So we are going to be touching on the subject of eating disorders in this episode. So if that's not for you, feel free to skip this one. It's pretty commonplace for little girls to take dance classes at, like, a very young age. In the same way so many little boys are put in, like, hockey and soccer. We're putting the kids in their gendered classes. So Hannah, what was your experience with dance growing up?
Yeah, I mean, like, every little girl, I loved my little ballet-themed things. I can't remember why I started doing ballet, because I was, like, I think 3 or 4. Like, I was pretty little. I lived right by this church that had, like, a ballet school kind of at the side of it. And so it was literally 2 blocks from my house. So I used to go, I think, every Saturday. And I remember I used to be sad because I have to miss cartoons in the morning to go do ballet. I think I did it for 3 or 4 years. And then by the time, it was kind of an intense place. Like, by the time I think I hit 7, they were like, you have to take 3 classes a week, because 7-year-olds go in our kind of, like, major production. And it was just, like, a lot. I've shown my year. I have home videos of me in recitals, and, like, I stick out for, like, a bad reason. I'm not a dancer. I was a little kind of fairy princess little girl, you know? I loved watching the Nutcracker. I loved the tutus. I loved
You're a girly girl.
Our little costumes that we would put on. But I still am not in touch with my body in the way that is required to be a proficient dancer in any sense. No sense of rhythm. Kind of forgot the routine every time and was just watching to see what everyone else was doing. So I was doing it two steps late. Head in the clouds. Ballet corps is kind of like the perfect way to describe my relationship with ballet, even as a child, in that I had like a Mary-Kate and Ashley VHS where they did ballet and I used to practice my, you know, positions, but that's as far as it went. And I just like to dress in ballet things, you know?
Yeah, it's just like the embodiment, and we'll talk about this, but like the embodiment of like girlhood, essentially. Yeah, I love the littlest kid ballet classes. There's like little roly-poly kids who come out, and then like there's the older dancer who comes out with them and she kind of guides them, but all, most of them are just like picking their noses or rolling around on the floor. I remember one little kid pulled up her, she pulled down her own pants or something during a routine and everyone was laughing because she had like a diaper on her. Like, it was crazy.
Aww.
Very cute. But yeah, I think a lot of people that I talked to did ballet specifically from age like 3 to 6, essentially. A lot of my friends growing up did that. I had a bit of a different experience with dance. I started dancing at age 5 and I went to a school out in Mississauga and I did ballet and jazz for a few years. And the owner of the school, he's like a famous Canadian dancer. He drove like a Lambo or whatever the fuck to school. Like, he'd like drive it and park it in the front lot. Jeez. Like, he was minted, and he was kind of known for being a bit mean during like performance rehearsals, because like we'd all rehearse in this like one big space. They'd open up the two studios and then he'd come in and he'd wear all black, and he was kind of austere and kind of scary, and he'd kind of yell at you. He was like this sexy gay man. like, he was very suave. But I ended up being taken out of the school because of a mean teacher. And I think my parents found that the recital spaces weren't very child-friendly. Like, during my first show, basically what they did was at the end of every year, similar to your school, they had, like, a big production. And it'd be themed, so we had, like, Alice in Wonderland and Sleeping Beauty. And then, like, the older dancers were the main, like, the lead parts. And then all of the younger dancers were kind of the surrounding parts. So we'd be dancing around them, similar to what happened at your school.
We just did the Nutcracker every year, though, which is the funny thing.
Your school's known for the Nutcracker, yeah.
For the Nutcracker, yeah.
Yeah, your Christmas production. We didn't really have a Christmas production. And my parents were angry because the final recital was 3 hours long, and I was 5, and my dance number was at the very end. So they kept us in, like, the backstage. It was, like, this huge performing arts center in Mississauga. We were in the backstage area, and it was freezing, and they didn't feed us or anything. My parents were really angry, so they didn't really like that about the school. Yeah, it's an intense school. It's like very prestigious, but as we'll find out throughout this episode, a little bit harmful. And then I moved to a school downtown where I did ballet, jazz, tap, hip hop, and triple threat, which I talked about last class. My parents were like really extending themselves to send me here. I think there was a lot of pressure among the parents, similar to your school, where they were like, you have to do multiple classes in order for your kid to excel. And I get it, like, to be training and to be like, to get good at something, you kind of have to be doing it really regularly. But it also felt like there was an element to, like, give us your money.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, with us, it was just so that you could be in the Nutcracker. You had to be able to do 3 classes a week. Yeah. I was never going to be a ballerina. I had a conversation with my mom about this recently. She was like, you could not have been a ballerina. So, yeah, no, it's fine. And I got over it.
I think a lot of parents succumb to, like, the peer pressure of it, too, because, you know, their kid wants so badly to, like, be a part of this production and not to be excluded. So then they're like, ugh, and then they kind of give in because they don't want their kid to be excluded.
Yeah.
It's not great. I did that at the downtown school until grade 9, but I kind of felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And my last show there, I had a really bad experience. And I think my parents felt like the wealthier kids were privileged more, even within the dances. I don't know if I believe them. I was, like, taller than a lot of the other kids, so I was often in the back. And I just wasn't as good. Like, I don't know. I feel like I really love dance, and I feel like I can dance, but, like, I wasn't as flexible. There were just certain things I was lacking, and I think I didn't have much of a drive as a kid to, like, really push myself in the way some other kids did. So I kind of got that, but my parents really felt like it was like a class thing. So I ended up moving to another place, more on the West End, in grade 10, and I did that for 2 years. And this is when my skill set, like, really grew. Like, I think because I really wanted to be there, I got a lot better at dancing within these 2 years. Like, I think I got pretty good. But then I just stopped because grade 11 came around, and it was kind of like, okay, are we going to keep paying for this? Whatever. But I just generally felt like dance was, like, a very, very big part of my life for my entire youth, but it always felt like it was wrapped up in shame for me. Like, I kind of dreaded going to every class, and I kind of felt like I wasn't as good as my peers. I never really felt like I was up to par, and I never felt like I was as wealthy as them, and I never felt like I really clicked with the girls in my programs. Like, I just felt like I just didn't fit in. So I don't know. I have a lot of like mixed feelings about dance, even though I'm really grateful I did it for so long. And we're going to get into this concept more. So basically, there isn't a ton of scholarship or like even articles that are readily available about this subject. So when I was researching it, I actually crowdsourced opinions from our listeners who are dancers, which really informed the general thrust of this episode. And I essentially asked them how they felt like the internet and social media had impacted dance for them. And the responses were overwhelmingly negative. So I want to start with ballet core, the fashion trend, because I think it neatly encompasses what we're going to be getting into in this episode. So what characterizes ballet core for you, Hannah? And like, are you attracted to it at all?
I think opaque tights, right? The tiny kind of black shorts, the dance shorts that a lot of people are wearing, obviously ballet flats in their myriad of different forms, like bodysuits. What are they called? Like bolios? What are boleros?
Oh, boleros. Yeah.
Boleros and like shrugs.
I think. What's a bolero?
I think it's similar to a shrug. It's the kind of sleeves of a shirt, sweater situation.
Oh.
The slicked back buns. A lot of fashion right now is just so ballet linked.
Yes. It's impossible to kind of like separate any current fashion trend from ballet core. It feels like it's kind of permeated like every single facet of fashion, which is interesting.
Yeah, it is.
You're exactly right. Do you like it? Have you worn ballet core?
I like it. I think my thing about ballet flats was that the minute they started becoming a thing, I was like, I know that this is going to be a flash in the pan. And it was just felt so hard to predict the longevity of them. And they're not particularly comfy shoes. And I never really invested in a proper pair. I have like a little pair that I got at the thrift store, but like they're not, you know. I love opaque tights. I've always loved opaque tights. So that's
she loves kind of fun. A thick pair of tights. I used to make fun of her for her thick tights.
Yeah. But I love it. And I like the colored tights. I haven't gotten a pair though because I'm like, colored tights are expensive and that shit rips. I like parts of it, but it just became kind of overwhelmingly apparent, which is always a problem with any kind of trend. I'm like, oh, I like pieces of this, or yeah, I wear that. But I just, once it becomes like a sort of labeled aesthetic, it becomes too much for me. And I sort of try and like stay away from it.
Yeah, you know, begging all of these publications to stop putting names on things so I can just wear clothing without feeling stupid. That's exactly what it is. I have two pairs of ballet flats, and one of them I wore when I was in New York in the fall, and I wore them everywhere, and I ended up getting a fucking ass injury because they have like no lumbar support. Like I got a full ass injury that I couldn't, I was out of commission for like 5 days.
And I'm so used to having like a chunkier sole on my shoes in some capacity. Like my everyday shoes are either kind of, I wear these riding boots or I have clogs. And so I'm used to having some elevation from the ground. And when I wear my ballet flats, I just feel like I'm walking on concrete in a way that I don't like.
I actually look more elegant in the winter because I have so much support. I got bounce.
Yeah. And I'm too short for that shit. Ballet flats like really make it clear
how short. But then you can be like, I'm so tiny. I'm so small.
Oh my God. No, tall girls always, it's such a grass is greener thing. Like,
I like being tall.
I would love to be taller.
I'm kidding. Yeah, you're right. So the trend straddles two of like the main big aspects of ballet culture, performance wear, and then you have rehearsal wear. So you'll get like, you know, there's this brand, I think it's pronounced Idiom. It's like a backwards version of the designer's name. Their spring summer collection incorporates a lot of like tulle and kind of like wing-like extensions on sleeves. And they have corsets and they have like string wrapped around the arms and legs. It's a really beautiful collection, which Hanako Maeda, who is the designer, said was inspired by the idea of ballet as a performance art and a sport, but with a rock and roll twist. Or you have like outfits trending on TikTok that are clearly inspired by performance wear and like Black Swan, so Swan Lake, essentially, or like what the girlies wear at the end of Center Stage, which is one of my favorite movies. You should all go watch it. But during their final performance, And then you have takes that are more like rehearsal wear styles that seem to be kind of the most popular route for people. So like Givenchy and Christian Siriano and like Simone Rocha. We're not entirely sure if it's Simone Roche or Simone Rocha. Someone please correct us, but I've heard both. Those designers are including like pink ribbons or ballet tights into their collections. So it's not much of a deviation from like the Sandy Liang trend last year.
I feel like Simone Roche or Rocha and Molly Goddard have been sort of doing ballet-inspired stuff first, like longer than a lot of people, and now it's become more popularized, but like that's been a big part of their aesthetic.
Yeah, and also Cecily Bonson, like the yeah, all of these designers have been kind of doing that for a bit. So it's been on the come up for a bit. And Reformation actually did a collaboration with the New York City Ballet, of which they said was inspired by a George Balanchine show. Do you know who George Balanchine is?
No.
Balanchine was essentially like the leading American choreographer of the 20th century who co-founded the New York City Ballet. And basically the Reformation line is very like rehearsal-esque. So lots of like wrap shirts and leg warmers and bodysuits and ballet flats, silk skirts, that kind of thing. Balletcore is extremely popular right now and it seems to have quite a bit of lasting power, I think because of its wearability and like adaptability.
I was going to say that it is just another take on athleisure wear, which there will always be a popular form of wearing athleisure in a more like casual daily context. And I feel like balletcore is sort of us moving away from the bike shorts of it all, but still staying in that realm, at least the rehearsal wear.
Yeah, and it feels like a bit more of a femme twist on that, because I feel like a lot of athleisure for a lot of the late 2010s, I felt like I was dressing a lot more like masculine during that time, but it feels like this is a bit more of, has a bit more of a feminine spin on it, I guess you could say. But that's definitely it. It's an extension of that. Yeah, the hashtag on TikTok.
Grandma.
The hashtag on TikTok has over a million views. And like, yeah, with ballet flats alone, we're seeing them absolutely everywhere. Again, I have two pairs. I kind of want to get more. I'm enjoying the trend. And there was an article I read for Refinery29 by Frances Sola Santiago, who's profiling the trend. And basically, she comes away with the point that balletcore has made ballet, which is historically very gatekeepy in the most literal sense, more accessible and inclusive. She says, "What's different about the recent display of balletcore, a trend that's dominated fashion for the past 2 years and only continues to grow, is the rebellious side that has been reimagining the ballet fashion stereotypes." Do you agree with her? Like, why do you think balletcore is so popular recently?
Well, because it's the whole, what were we calling it? It's like the year of the girl kind of thing, the girlhood of it all. I mean, it's not in the same kind of universe as Barbiecore last summer, even though aesthetically they're very different. It's a nostalgia, girls specifically our age, the things that we like as kids are coming back in fashion. I also think as much as the Y2K trend felt really overdone, what I had fun with about it was just that we were wearing things that we didn't get to wear the first time around because we were too young, but we thought that when we were older we would wear. And I think that it's sort of similar to that. I don't know, I think it's just leaning into the girlhood of it all, so it would make a ton of sense why this other facet of that time in our lives is also coming back into fashion.
Yeah, and I think through researching, I found that there's like, it's kind of a double-edged thing. So like on the side that you're saying is like the very positive side of it, right? Like I think so many kids felt like they couldn't continue with ballet, had bad experiences with ballet, never got to do ballet. You know, it's expensive.
Liked the look of it too.
Liked the look of it, you know. Well, they liked the look of it, but they weren't able to do it. You know what I mean? And so I think, yeah, like you're saying, it's a second go around and you're seeing it spread in a way. Like a lot of adult ballet classes are opening up, which was not a thing before this. Ballet was something you had to start as a child. And now it's like you're doing these adult ballet classes. Some people are kind of like bar. I mean, and I have like a lot of thoughts about bar and a lot of thoughts about hot ballet. And we talk about this in this episode, but I don't like the way that those treat ballet as a sport and ignore the art of ballet, because I think that artistry is like an extremely important element of this style. I have my opinions about that, but it's becoming more accessible to people. But then on the other side of it, like one of the people who responded to my prompt said that a lot of ballet dancers had kind of moved away from traditional ballet clothes because of their lack of inclusivity. So, like, there's been so much discourse about, like, pink tights on darker skin tones. There's a lot of talk about the sleek ballet buns with curly hair, what have you. So they said that this turn towards, like, traditional wear, it can make it more accessible because it's so popular and it's allowing people to kind of explore something they didn't get to explore. But then on the other side of it, it's also kind of regressive because it hones in on these more traditional elements like the pink and the bows, these more feminine elements. And the feminine elements aren't inherently bad, but I want to get in depth about what those feminine elements have always signified within ballet.
I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I feel like in the 2010s, I was seeing the discourse about changes in ballet and trying to kind of disrupt the intense, like, traditionalism within, not the sport, the
art form.
Dance, it's an art form. Yes, thank you. Within the art form.
Getting right into that, thinking about what's so popular right now, we have, on the one hand, this, like, infantilization, this, like, nostalgia and the girlhood trend. And on top of that, skinniness seems to be making a comeback, in part because I think people wouldn't shut the fuck up about it after Kim Kardashian lost weight, which I, like, when that happened, I was like, the more you keep talking about it, the more it's going to become a thing. And I feel like we kind of ushered that into existence a little bit by, like, I think people wanted to bring attention to it, but in a way that it actually kind of felt like in bringing attention to it, we kind of manifested it in a weird way.
Also, just, I think that body trends also exist on this pendulum.
Totally.
I saw someone, I can't remember who said this, maybe it was on TikTok or Instagram Reels, but someone was just like, you know why skinniness is coming back in such a strong way? It's because every time feminism becomes more, like, solidified in the mainstream, it gets undermined by things like this, and it almost feels like we are in an age of post-feminism. I really believe it. Unfortunately, like, it feels like culturally there is such a sense of that.
And I feel no resonance with mainstream feminism today at all. Like, I don't get it. I don't recognize it. I don't know what it is. I don't like it. I don't like where it is right now.
It barely exists right now. And I do think that this sort of return to, like, the hyper-feminine and the, like, whatever of it all is, like, fun in a sense, but it also just, I do think it's, like, setting, like, gendered stereotypes in such an extreme way that feels palpable right now. And I think that this is when this kind of, like, skinniness comes in. And so, when going back to, like, the 2000s, it's like growing up in the 2000s was a mental minefield as far as body image stuff. And it would be impossible for those clothes to be in fashion without people feeling the pressure to have the body types that we were used to seeing in those clothes.
Also. Well, yeah, and, like, I'm seeing more and more people I know feeling way more comfortable with talking about wanting or, like, needing to be skinny. Like, it's really jarring because I was very thin growing up, just, like, naturally. My dad's really skinny. Like, it's just kind of a thing. And I've, like, known my entire life never to talk about my body, never to talk about being thin. Never. It's just not, like, it's not really socially acceptable. So it's kind of crazy now knowing these thin girls being like, I need to be thinner, like that kind of thing. I haven't seen that in years. So it's kind of frightening watching it come back. And so the aesthetic of thinness is something that's plagued ballet for decades, specifically American ballet, because of one person in particular. Do you want to guess who that is?
Audrey Hepburn.
No,
I don't know.
But Audrey Hepburn also has an interesting relation to this concept, but it's George Balanchine.
I see.
So, like I said, George Balanchine co-founded New York City Ballet, which was the first world-class ballet school in the U.S. His style of dance is extremely influential. If you're curious, there's this trend on TikTok that compares the Balanchine style to the Bolshoi technique from Russia. And, like, if you watch them, you could kind of argue that Balanchine's technique appears to be more fluid, maybe looks a bit less sharp, has a bit more flourish to it. There's no value judgment on either the Bolshoi or Balanchine techniques. They're both great in their own ways. But what I was actually referring to here was the Vaganova technique, not the Bolshoi technique, both of which are Russian, but not to be confused with the other. You can see his, like, very distinctive style being popularized here. But yeah, so Balanchine launched the careers of countless dancers, and he's known for beginning romantic relationships with his muses. And while his former dancers still have a lot of reverence for him, like, it's undeniable his impact, many women like Suzanne Farrell, who he actually kicked out of the company, and Gelsey Kirkland, who would develop a very infamous cocaine addiction. These are both very famous ballerinas, have come out about the rather psychologically and emotionally abusive training environment that he cultivated. This was in the 60s and 70s. Balanchine has passed away. And while he's undeniably had an influence over American ballet in terms of style, the other major influence he's had, even after he's passed away, has been in almost originating and perpetuating a widespread systemization of eating disorders. He placed a lot of emphasis on what we'll call the Balanchine body, which Suzanne Farrell has described as leggy, linear, musical, unsentimental, and of course, untouchably beautiful. It's the kind of body you'll see in most dance companies today. All of the dancers are like really tall and lithe and thin and like graceful. They have like very long necks and they have long limbs, so you can really see their extensions. He wanted his dancers to be bony and sinewy. And this is an idea very much echoed by most companies today, with the justification that like, oh, this kind of body emphasizes the art form, like, you know, with the extensions, or it emphasizes like conformity on stage. Like, oh, all of our dancers have to be the same height. They all have to look identical so that what you're watching is aesthetically pleasing, essentially. Balanchine, and this is why you bringing up Audrey Hepburn is interesting. So Balanchine was born in St. Petersburg and he grew up there during World War I. And a lot of the dancers he was surrounded by in his youth were literally starving and sick, which definitely informed the way he perceived the aesthetics of ballet later down the road. And like we know about Audrey Hepburn, a lot of the reason that she was so thin was because she was malnourished as a child during World War II.
Yeah, exactly. Audrey Hepburn, her body, which also like wasn't actually in vogue when she first kind of appeared on the scene, at least not in America. But by her being Audrey Hepburn and becoming the icon she is, I think made it more popularized, like that kind of boy, quote unquote, like body type that she was presented as having. But she literally grew up during the war and was like, I did not choose to have this body. I grew up malnourished. Yeah.
And some people like naturally have that body, like it is a body, but hers actually wasn't. And she talked about that extensively. Something I think that's always been a tension in dance, and this is so interesting when you were asking me whether or not you should call it a sport or an art form, even though this is a season about art, right? Is this kind of push and pull between art and sport. Like, yes, ballet is very much an art form. It's like expressive and it's like really beautiful. It uses music, musicality, but it's also a sport in the sense that it requires like an insane amount of athletic prowess. Avery Trufelman, who does a podcast called Articles of Interest that both Hannah and I listen to, and Hannah recommended this episode to me. She has an episode for her podcast about point shoes. Do you want to just tell us what it's about a little bit, Hannah?
Well, it was about, you know, point shoes classically as we know them are typically pink or white. They're supposed to feel like an extension of the leg. You know, they are supposed to seem like they're the dancer's feet, but they were that color because that was when people were imagining ballet dancers strictly as white dancers. And once you put them on anyone with a darker skin tone, that kind of illusion disappeared. And so it's just basically about the push, like, from, like, black dancers to, it's been a while since I've listened to it.
Part of it is about the racism, yeah. The push from black dancers to basically make it so that they can also convey this artistry and like not have, the foot looking like it's cut off with a pink shoe. A lot of black dancers were literally painting and dyeing their shoes. That's like the later part of the episode. And that's really interesting as it ties into this, because she goes into this idea also. She kind of foregrounds it with this idea that dancers are considered artists. So there's very little protection in place for them when they get physically injured. The traditional point shoe, she says, has like very little cushioning in it, which means that the foot is repeatedly injured unless the dancer adds protection themselves. It's all DIY. So like, oh, the black dancer is dyeing their own shoes. Like, that's the expectation. Like, well, no, you dye your own shoes. Why would we do that for you? Dancers adding cushioning to it. It's like, why would we do that? And shoemakers who tried to make the shoes comfier or easier to use were lambasted for like going the easy route and like cheating.
Right.
And it's just this interesting conflation of like art and suffering, whereas if we thought of it as a sport, we wouldn't conflate the two.
If you were an athlete in our minds, right, we would want you to have the best equipment to have the best performance. We would be trying to advance the technology available to you so that you could, you know, give it your best.
To maximize your skills. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think the Balanchine body very much plays into this paradox. Like, the dancer needs to be, they need to be fit enough to be able to execute these, like, really difficult moves, but we also want them to look sickly and, like, thin to highlight the artistry of what they're doing. And it just doesn't make sense. Like, it's paradoxical. And what's important to remember is that this extreme thinness isn't a tradition that's been a part of ballet since its inception. It's very much an invention of the 20th century. And that's so important to keep in mind because I think we forget that. Or a lot of people just don't know that. I brought in an artist named Susanna Haight for this episode. She's a former dancer, or like movement artist, as she prefers to describe it, who went to high school with us, actually. And she and I spoke at length about just how embedded these beauty standards are in the culture of dance, even at our high school. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Susanna.
No problem.
For context, Susanna and I went to high school together, but we were in different majors. Like, I felt like we never fully overlapped. Susanna was in dance. I was in drama, as I've made way too clear on this podcast. And yeah, I think Susanna is going to be a great guest for this episode because she both has worked professionally in dance. She's worked in this kind of multimedia space with like dance and social media and film. And I think she'll bring some great insights. So hello, Susanna. Welcome.
Hello.
I guess let's start off by I just wanted to ask you to kind of tell the listeners a bit about yourself, you know, how you got into dance, what you're doing now.
I've essentially danced my whole life. It was like one of those things where I started when I was 6 and then kind of just became a part of my life really young. I went to the National Ballet School of Canada for summers, and it was very much like my trajectory from like the age of 10 was like, you're going to be a dancer. This is your life purpose. And so I ended up doing that, and I would dance like 30 to 40 hours a week. I did competition, so I didn't just do ballet. I did like tap, I did jazz, I did contemporary dance, I did acro, did a lot of that. And then in high school, I went to ESA, and there was like, we had majors, and I was a dance major, and I did dancation, which was like the after school like dance company that the school had. And then essentially after that, I went to Montreal, where I went to like the Contemporary Dance School of Montreal over there. And I studied for 3 years, and then I freelanced for 3 years. And then I did a bit of a pivot during COVID. And now I work in the film industry.
I'm very pro career pivots in your mid-20s.
Oh, same.
Important.
Me too.
Yeah. I'll talk to my friend's parents and they're like, I didn't know what I was going to do till I was 30. And then they're like really successful. And you're like,
yeah,
I'm so inspired.
Yeah. I think it like rounds you out as a human. Like to think of like doing one thing your whole life kind of seems scary to me. But I also am like, I have commitment issues. So maybe that's it.
Maybe. So what was your experience, you know, training as a dancer growing up? Like, do you want to talk about kind of like how that made you feel? Did you enjoy it? Were there trying times? I know that there was a bit of a tension at ESA, especially with the ballet program. And so if you wanted to speak a bit on that, feel free.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot to say. I always say that pursuing dance is like kind of like the relationship you have with your mother, where you like love her and you want her to love her, but then you also hate her at the same time, and she makes you hate yourself. Like, I don't know if that's everyone's relationships with their mom, but... Or like any kind of parental figure in your life where it's like there's a lot of tension. That's kind of what dance felt like for me. Growing up, it came really natural to me and I excelled very easily in it. So, and I have like dyslexia. I have like a bunch of neurodivergent, like ADHD, kind of like all of these things. So school felt like the place that I didn't belong, but dance felt like the place I did belong. Like it really... It was like my saving grace for me. And I dealt with depression and social anxiety as a kid. So like dance was in my childhood. It was like the thing that made me feel like I belonged somewhere. That changed after puberty, where now all of a sudden your body's changing and there's more pressure on you to be perfect and to kind of fit into a certain standard. That kind of comes in later, around the age of 13, when your body starts to change, you kind of start to realize it gets more serious, I guess. And I remember I went to the National Ballet School of Canada summer program because you have to do that program in order to get into the school. And my parents really wanted me to be like a ballerina because they were like, that's how she's going to have her career. She's like going to be a ballerina. And that's like, that will be the thing. So I did the summer program. And I remember there was this really thin, frail girl. Basically, for context, there's like 30 girls at the age of 12, and they're all competing to like be a part of the school. That's kind of like what happens. And only like two are picked out of like a whole group of girls who get into the summer program. And there was this one girl in particular who was so thin that she had a letter from her doctor saying like she can't do the full day of dancing because her heart is very sensitive because she's so thin. And she actually had like a genetic disorder. Like she wasn't starving herself. I think this was just like, this was just her body. And so at the end of like the month long program, they ended up picking her, which I was like, wow, okay, like this girl is sick. Like she can't dance the whole day. All of these other girls who are healthy, they are not as thin as her, but they're like strong enough that they can actually show up to class and like do the whole thing. And they're picking a girl who is like sick. And that was the time where I was like, okay, I don't think I like ballet and I don't think it's for me and I don't fit in. And I became very aware of the fact that I wasn't going to be a ballerina because of the body that I had. Mm-hmm. I also experienced a lot of bullying from other girls in the program about what I was eating, which now looking back, I'm like, clearly that's an internalized thing from either their mothers or like the parental figures around them. So I was kind of like, ballet sucks. Like it didn't really affect how I saw myself. I just knew that I didn't fit in there. That would come in later when I was like 18, when I was like pursuing it fully as like an adult. That's kind of when I started to experience like starving myself. And long story kind of short, I ended up getting into contemporary dance and did ESA, and we had to do ballet. It was mandatory. There were teachers there who I won't name, but you probably know which teacher. Well, yes. And it was very obvious that she favored the skinnier woman in the room, and she would say things like, you know, I can see your lunches, because we would have ballet after lunch, and obviously we're gonna, I don't know, yeah, just stuff like that. And
the crazy thing is like ESA is a public school and like it's not a company either, so the
they took it
insane. Yeah, yeah, and like the school itself is very intense in general, but like the way that the dance program manifested is so disgusting. And
yeah,
they had really severe effects. Serious effects.
So they took it so seriously. They took the company so seriously. I remember one year, and I didn't find this out until after I graduated, there was a girl who died from anorexia who was in the dance program. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you heard about this.
Yes, I did.
And yeah, I think people don't realize just how bad it is. Like people know how bad it is based on like watching, I think, movies that have dance in it. There's always like one character that like has bulimia, but it's like kind of glazed over. Like it is really serious. Like it is really serious. And looking back on the things that were said to me as a child, child by adults, is like, it's gross. It's disgusting. And I don't really understand it because I'm like I'm an adult now. And I'm like, I think it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It's very systemic and like kind of cyclical, like teachers imparting the abuse that they went through onto their students. And so like I was in the rec program at Jean Boutillier as a kid, and that was recreational. And one of the teachers told me she was going to shoot me. And my parents took me out of the school because they were like, no, like, you can't talk to a child like that.
It's insane. I remember I was in ballet class and one of the teachers was making me, like, I didn't know the counts for like the exercise. And she was like, count it while you do it. And I was having a hard time. And she's like, what are you, retarded? And I was like, actually, I'm dyslexic. Like, and she was like, I put her in her place. I like left the class. Like,
God, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry you went through that. It's like beautiful what you've been able to make out of dance as an adult, considering having to go through that as a kid. And like, it seems that you bring joy to your practice. So that's really awesome and admirable.
Well, yeah. I mean, it took me a long time to get there. There was like a really dark period from like the age of 18 to 23 where I was really in it. And when you start trying to make money off of it, it gets to the point where you're like, I have to be skinnier to make money. I have to be skinnier in order to like make this career work for me. And that was really a point in my life where it was like, the thing that had brought so much joy to my life was actually making me hate myself. And I had to kind of decide, like, what is the life that I want for myself? Is it worth it? At the end of the day, you're starving yourself, but are you really making that much money? And respect is a really important thing for me. Like, I need to feel like I'm respected. And when you're a dancer in the room, you're kind of just a mannequin, or at least it felt that way for me. And that was like a really big reason why I decided to pursue other art forms, because I kind of felt trapped, and doing other art forms and getting into film and like having other forms of income made it so I can enjoy dance again.
And with regards to the National Ballet School in Toronto, many of the people who attended the ESA dance program had been going, like Susanna, to NBS their entire lives. A lot of them were in, I think, even more comprehensive programs, only to basically be chucked out once they came of age, often because of really minor physical imperfections, like not being thin enough, having a neck that was too long, not having a perfect turnout. And this is like, this is also the time when you're hitting puberty. Like, you're going to gain weight, your body's going to change, it's completely normal. So you can imagine the number this would do to you psychologically, you know?
Yeah, I've seen the effects in people I know, and the way that being a lifelong ballerina and then entering young adulthood, it's abusive.
It's horrific, honestly. Yeah. And then to go from that to a public school that also perpetuates those ideas is like unfathomable to me. Like,
it's, yeah, I've talking to girls in dance at our school who didn't perfectly fit that body standard, even at our just our school, it sounded absolutely brutal. I do think it was like a bit of a factory for eating disorders.
Speaking to the ballet core fashion trend, there's an article I was reading from The Independent, which interviews a former ballerina named Alice Robb, who wrote a book called Don't Think, Dear, which is all about quitting the toxic world of ballet. And in the interview, she says, when I quit ballet, there was some element of relief in realizing that I didn't have to wear a leotard anymore, and it didn't matter if I gained 5 pounds. Susanna kind of echoed something really similar to this when she talked about ballet core. What do you think of ballet core? Like, do you think it's influenced the world of dance?
I think that ballet core has absolutely nothing to do with ballet itself. What the fashion industry does so well is taking things and then commodifying them and selling them to people. And that's kind of what they've done with ballet. In my opinion, the ballet core that we see on social media is very much inspired by girlhood. Like, yes. If you think about like coquette core, or like cottagecore, like it's kind of similar in that it's like presenting hyper femininity in a way that can be worn. And I think it's cool. Like, it's very much inspired by the ballet that you think of when you're like 5 and you get to wear the tutus and you get to wear the pink bodysuit. And it's like very fun and it's girly and it's like girlhood. But the kind of ballet that I did was not fun and frilly and pink. It was like you wore navy and black bodysuits and it was boring and they were unflattering. There was no frills. We did not get to wear skirts because if you wear skirts, it covers like your hips and your butt and they want to see how you're turning out. Like, it was not like cute in any way.
It was serious.
Yeah, it was serious and everyone had to look the same. And it was about conformity. Whereas, like, I feel like the ballet core we see is frilly and it's fun and it's girly. And it's, like, completely separate from, like, what ballet is, at least to me, and, like, the ballet that I grew up doing. I think people, like, look at it and they go, that's cute. They don't think any deeper of what, like, ballet is.
Well, and I feel like that was kind of the whole purpose of this ballet culture throughout the past century, was like making it look as like effortless and easy as possible, but actually so much suffering went on behind that kind of perfect image.
I think what makes ballet core so catchy for fashion designers is it subconsciously puts this, like, new hero, like, heroin chic is coming back, right? Like, it feels mm-hmm. like skinniness is, like, still very pervasive, and it kind of, it feels like it's able to, like, enforce those standards without actually, like, justifying it, because it's just ballet core. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
totally. Like, it already fits with the whole sample size.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Exactly. In her book, Rob says, ballet does not exist in a vacuum. It is a laboratory of femaleness, a test tube world in the middle of modern New York or London or Paris in which traditional femininity is exaggerated. The traits ballet takes to an extreme, the beauty, the thinness, the stoicism, and silence and submission are valued in girls and women everywhere. By excavating the psyche of a dancer, we can understand the contradictions and challenges of being a woman today. So I just think that's really fascinating when we think about the theme of this episode. What do you think of what she's saying here?
Well, I think it makes sense tying that to ballet core as a trend, as something coming out. And yes, this kind of re-emphasizing thinness. I think that we are really in a place where the culture is trying to... It doesn't feel as outspoken, but there is a cultural push to subjugate women again in a way that, like, geniusly, we found ways to sell it to us, so we'll do it ourselves a lot of the time through yeah. trends. But then also, I mean, if you go to the United States, like, reproductive rights and all of these things are very much being taken away and very much at threat. So it's like, the thing about eating disorders and about body dysmorphia and all of that stuff is that it's not just like being insecure. It's a mind-consuming thing. I can't compare my own experiences to people who I know who've had it a lot more severe. But, like, even in my own past with that kind of stuff, sometimes you're like, I cannot believe the amount of mental energy I am putting towards these thoughts and putting towards this, the way it is not allowing me to have fun. I feel worse all the time. I feel weak. Oh my God, why am I crying? I've been feeling, sorry.
It's okay.
No, it's just that I just lately really been feeling like very, very gendered ways that the world is like, I've had a lot of experiences recently that feel very gendered, that feel like kind of harsh reminders of we have so much progress just like on like a day-to-day level for women, and I do feel subjugated just by living in the patriarchy. This is so god okay
no and Hannah, like, yeah, it's, and you're fucking right, and I think that you're gonna make me cry now. But it's this thing where it's like, if we're gonna talk about gender depression, and like there's this, not to bring in scholarship here, but there's this like famous article by second wave feminist named Sandra Lee Bartke, and it's called On Psychological Oppression. And it basically talks about the way that oppression, traditionally it's been used in like anti-colonial scholarship, where like the colonized subjects will essentially perpetuate colonization internally within themselves because they've come to believe this like oppression about themselves. They've come to internalize it. And then she uses it to talk about women and the way that women will like culturally condition themselves within the patriarchy. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, beauty standards and habits. And it's like thinking about the absolute amount of brain space that is taken up by us consumed by these ideas of beauty. And I think this is something people are talking about more online with like the anti-aging stuff and like the backlash towards that. It's just like, it's a fucking distraction. Like, we are being distracted because we're being consumed with this like crippling self-doubt and self-hatred. It's something every single woman goes through, some women worse than others, but every single woman. Talking to men about this, like they do not under, it's just not the same. It's just not the fucking same.
And also, when you're starving yourself, you don't have the physical or mental strength. When we're all, you know, across the board, not taking care of our bodies in that way, like, it, we have less energy and less power and less ability to combat those things. Like, yeah. It literally impacts our ability to function and to, like, really, I don't know, even think about this kind of stuff in a proper way. Like, I just...
Well, totally.
Yeah.
And even taking it out of, like, the extreme of eating disorders, just like, oh, I spend 45 minutes a day doing my fucking makeup. For what? For what? You know? And it's something that we've just completely stopped questioning, completely stopped challenging.
I know.
To the point where now we actually see it as empowering. It's like, that is insane. I could be doing anything else. I could be... And, you know, going to that controversial video where she's like, can you spell Pharaoh? What she's getting at there is like, yes, we are distracted with these things, which is another function of the patriarchy, like to be distracting us with our own oppression.
And the thing is that we also, being intelligent women who've lived in the world, we're also very aware of the fact that if we don't put effort into the way that we look, our lives are materially worse.
Totally, yeah.
Because men are in control, and men do treat you better when you look better. Men, yeah. If when you put in the effort, you are supposed to, like, presentable in a way that a man can just, like, roll out of bed. Like, it actually does make a difference, and that's
the standards that women have to meet is, like, insane. Just even thinking about Toronto and the, like, if we're gonna go to the Toronto dating scene and, like, looking at the standard that a woman has to look like versus, like, a man and then they're dating, it's like, I sound like an incel, but it's fucking true. Like, the amount of effort we have to put into ourselves, to our bodies, to our appearances, to our faces, to everything. And man, yeah, a man could just fucking, you're saying, roll out of bed and get the hottest girl you could think of. It's just like, it's hard not to be incensed by that. I feel like hyperfemininity is very mixed up in the concept of self-regulation, right? So like, women are trained at such a young age in all of these really arduous routine procedures like shaving, learning how to apply makeup, how to do your hair, how to sit in a ladylike way, how to be graceful. Like, I would sit with my legs open on the couch as a kid, I'd be comfy, and my mom would be like, Maya, close your legs, don't sit like that. And it's like, that's not or she wouldn't, like, I wasn't allowed to drink out of beer bottles for a long time when I was, like, in my early 20s, because my mom was like, your grandma won't like to see that, you know? And it's like, my mom is also someone who's been subject to these things. Yeah. I'm not blaming my mother. And ballet is just really an extension of this idea of self-regulation, but within the arts, which I think is so interesting. Like I said, I don't think it's an inherently bad thing, because I don't think femininity is inherently bad. I still love ballet and its aesthetics, but when it comes to something that's so systemic and abusive and so reflective of the patriarchy, like, we do have to question it. Like, Balanchine was a straight man who also happened to conduct sexual and romantic relationships with a lot of his dancers. And his influence over the art, which is so dominated by women, is a man's influence, which is crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy. And then it's like, of course, who wants to see a studio full of women uniformly dancing with their bodies that they've been, like, torturing for you more than a straight man? That's all I'm gonna say.
Send it, babe. And Rob has this other quote where she says, ballet still has such a hold on the feminine imagination. So many little girls go through a ballet phase. So I think it's like an unexplored, underanalyzed part of femininity. It is the same appeal as princess culture, but it's more attainable. And so obviously, like, that's why it's having such a boom in popularity during this girlhood era. But what also booms during an era about girlhood is, like, girlish prepubescent bodies, like, right, thinness. And there's no way to separate those two things.
And, like I said earlier, all of this kind of girlhood stuff that's in fashion is stuff from when we were little girls. And when we were little girls, it was the 2000s. And when we were little girls, every single woman in the public eye was emaciated and starving themselves and...
And that's not, like, an exaggeration, like genuinely emaciated.
Yes, like, the body standards were inhumane for women. And so it's like the 2000s being back and all of these, like, things that, you know, we weren't really as cognizant of because we were little girls. It's like that stuff is coming back with it, you know. Yeah. And it was such a fucking sexist era, just generally speaking. Yeah.
The dark ages. Yeah. So finally getting to the internet of it all. If hyperfemininity is all about self-regulation and ballet is about hyperfemininity, what better place for those two concepts to link and build than social media? The vast majority of my responses to my prompt discussed in one way or another the influence of social media and especially phone cameras upon the culture of dance. And so I wanted to ask, like, in what ways is dance, do you think, different today than it was, you know, when you were growing up, just like the industry and the classes, etc.?
I think dance is much more pervasive in pop culture than it has ever been. I mean, like, every pop song has a dance that goes with it that people can do.
The apple dance.
Yeah, or like now we see Charlie XCX, this one.
You know? Yeah, is that the apple one? I don't know either. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because, like, I can't do TikTok dances. Like, I'm so bad at it, which is really funny because I'm so bad at it. But I realize, like, it's because when I dance, I'm so serious that I can't not be, like, people are having fun. I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Like, I'm too serious. Yeah, I think it's like much more of a thing. But also like that idea of dance is so much different than the dancing that I do. I think there, just like there are subcultures, there are different subcultures of dance and different communities of dance based on what genre you're kind of in. So like what's really popular is sort of more commercialized dance. Mm. That is like the TikTok dance. And that's what people like when I say I'm a dancer, that's what they think that I do. And I'm like, that's not what I do at all.
Is it kind of like hip hop contemporary fusion? Like,
all I can say is it's commercial dance, which I guess would be more hip hop inspired, yeah. More club inspired.
Because they have like K-pop dance classes now too, which I'm like, what does that mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I'm assuming like, is like kind of hip hop-y.
Yeah. Hip hop, jazz.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's not really the dance that I grew up doing.
Yeah.
Like that kind of form of dance didn't exist when I was a kid. It was like you did jazz and you did ballet and you did contemporary. And there was hip hop, but it wasn't the same kind of dance, nor was it very cool to do hip hop as a kid. Like, I don't think it was.
Oh, no one wants to see my hip hop routine.
Yeah. Like, it was not cool at all.
It was like a bunch of dorky white kids doing. Like,
yeah. And you're like wearing the worst costumes. Like, yeah,
it's the sideways, like a fitted.
The sideways hat and like Converse and like. Yeah. Now it's a bit different. Like, it's definitely changed with TikTok. Like, TikTok has changed the concept of dance itself. Mm. That's why I call myself a movement artist, because I don't even know how to describe the dance I do. It's like a fusion of like everything I've ever learned. There's like martial arts in there. There's like, I grew up playing video games, so like a lot of fight stuff, I feel like I'm inspired by that in dance. And there's like a lot of different like elements at play in the way that I move, but it's not like, it's not TikTok,
which is cool. I think some like range of styles is also important.
Yeah,
styles and forms.
But I think that dance is much more integrated into pop culture now.
Hannah, if I described dance on social media as a kind of panopticon, would you understand what I was saying? Like, do you get that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's like if you're dancing on a stage for people, you're not necessarily then able to like go back and watch yourself dance, but like you're very much observed in a different way and you have the capacity to observe yourself in turn when you're dancing online and like compare yourself to other people. Like if a dance is trending or whatever, you're making comparisons to all of your peers doing that same dance.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, dance is already, it's a very regulative environment. It's an art and it's also a skill. Like, of course, you're going to be like honing and regulating and shaping your skills. Like, of course, in any art form. And that's great. But this is adding another element to it. People talked about there being a major shift in dance once Instagram introduced video content. And this was in a few ways. For one, social media had become a sort of CV for dancers. More and more, it's like a way to book jobs. How do you think the presence of like a camera phone has affected kind of the impact, like the experience of like training and like development in dance?
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, thankfully that was after my time. Like, but yeah, I mean, I know when anyone goes in to do like a class or like a drop-in class, like the choreographer always has a phone at the front of the room and they're always recording the class to like post on social media. And I think it has to do a lot with the fact that people get more jobs if they have more followers on Instagram. And I talked to a friend of mine who is a choreographer and they were like, oh, I applied for like to teach at the studio and they asked me how many followers I had on Instagram. It's kind of like, oh, well, if we have this choreographer who has this massive following and they're teaching classes, like we're going to get more people coming in and we're going to make more money. And that's another reason why I kind of distance myself from dance, is because you have to exist online. Like you gotta put yourself out there. You gotta show everything you're doing, because the more followers you have, the more jobs you get realistically. And so it kind of feels like it's like necessary for our survival to like have a following.
It's like a, what's the term? Something about the means. Like, it's like an evil necessity or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's like, it feels like it's necessary.
That's really crazy to think about, that like a teacher would need a large following, because it's like, people are going to want to dance. Like, they're always going to want to dance and take up dance classes. So it's like, why do you need to have a following to do that? But
yeah,
I find, like, just thinking about it, like, it also feels like it makes dance a bit less about the actual feeling of dancing and, like, the movement and the experience of the dancer and more about, like, the finished result and, like, looking perfect. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Which I think is so interesting.
Yeah. And that's a part of the problem with it, is that it's not just about, yeah, learning and feeling good and the process of it. It's just about the end result and, like, what you have to show. And that's why I like films, because, like, my favorite part about film is, like, the process of it. It's not actually, like, I could give a shit about, like, the end result of a film that I am a part of, be like, the finished result of it. I love just, like, the process of making it and having, like, a group, a community of people who are working on this thing together.
Yeah. And you get so many tries with film, too. Like, you can do it over and over again until you are happy with it. But the process is way longer than the actual result is, which is interesting.
Yeah.
This has also led to an increase of cameras in the training space. So, like, back when I was dancing, a class would usually be split up where, like, the first half is for warm-up, and then the second is split between, like, learning new moves, and then by the end of the year, rehearsing choreography. But one person who responded spoke about how they'd be in dance classes now where half of the class was dedicated to filming the choreography instead. Have you heard of Millennium Dance Complex?
No.
Basically, it's this dance studio that started in LA, but is now in, like, a number of other cities. And it kind of popularized these viral videos online where they'd have, like, different groups of dancers perform the same choreography to the same snippet of a song several times, but it'll be, like, one video. You've probably seen one of these online. Usually they're dancing in front of this red wall that says unity is diversity. You've probably caught me watching some of them, to be honest, because I used to love these videos.
My social media was so not dance-centric that, like, unless a dance went really viral, I wasn't gonna see
Well, and these went mega viral. So they've launched the careers of tons of dancers and choreographers like Jade Chenoweth or Jojo Gomez or Yanis Marshall. And they are genuinely very diverse. Like, this is taking us out of ballet. You see a range of body types and genders and skin colors in these videos. You see a really vast array of dance styles. Like, Yanis Marshall's famous for his heels choreography, which is so awesome. Like, he wears heels and then everyone dances with him, and it's great. They've 100% contributed to this wave of, like, inclusivity in dancing on the internet. You know, like, we're being exposed to aspects of dance that we would never have seen before social media, and aspects of dance that are outside of the traditional institution. But the thing about these videos is that they've given way to this uptick in teachers and dancers wanting or needing to film their classes and their training, and also a wave in people wanting to go viral on social media to get a leg up in their career. Like, remember, very similar to sports, like, the lifespan of a dancer is super short. It's really hard to make money as a professional dancer. So social media is kind of this necessary evil, which is a term I could not for the life of me remember when I was talking to Susanna. I kept being like, necessary? It's bad. It's badly necessary.
That's me every day on this podcast.
That's me as a baby. But do you see how the idea of self-regulation would, play into this camera work?
You know, you can also use the guise of, like, it's so important that we can see ourselves from every angle and we can, like, so we can really perfect things. But, I mean, there's already so much perfectionism in dance that it's sort of insane to want to, like, even take that up another notch anyways. I mean, at least with ballet, like,
it takes this element out of it where it makes dance all about the finished product and takes so much of the, like, feeling and experiential aspect of dance out of it. Like, what about the dancer and why they dance, you know what I mean? And that's kind of taken out of it because it's all about the viewer and the spectator.
I've had conversations with a friend who's a former ballerina and who kind of stepped away from dance for a long time but has sort of returned to it in more of, like, a performance art way, like, very talented dancer,
like Susanna.
Yeah. And was explaining to me, you know, how dance and, like, movement is, like, it's for me, and, you know, it's never been a form of self-expression and I've never really, like, been able to see it that way, but, like, hearing someone describe it the way, like, any other artistic medium would speak to you, it's like, I think, yeah, it takes away, like, what it is doing for the actual individual dancer, what they are saying with their movements.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Susanna has also been doing recently, and she talks about this extensively. The person who talked about the camera in the class who responded to me said, I think the need to perfect and perform for Instagram has really tarnished the class space and the community that's formed there. There's something so special about circling up and watching small groups perform at the end of class, cheering and supporting one another, and learning from one another. This feeling just isn't the same when everyone has their cameras out and is worried about capturing footage of themselves. And like, yeah, going back to like Balanchine and ballet corps and this idea of like dance as a final product, like we're not putting enough emphasis on the actual enjoyable activity for the people who do it, which is again why your friend is moving towards performance art. Do you have kind of a philosophy or an approach to your craft? Like, I know you work with this kind of multimedia kind of element to it.
For me, dance has always been about autonomy and freedom, which was why pursuing it took that away from me. It was like, no longer do I have autonomy or freedom. So like the fact that I can do dance and I can bring in other art forms is like, dance then becomes something more than just dance. And I actually don't like the word dance because I find that has a lot of connotations that I don't actually like associate. I prefer to call myself like a movement artist because I feel like dance has, there's like a right or wrong in terms of dance, whereas just like movement is so much more like open-ended. It can be anything. Going back to like my childhood self when I dance is really important, and knowing that there is no right or wrong and I can move any way I want and that I can play with objects, because I do a lot of object work in my dance practice.
Her stuff is very cool. You guys should check it out.
Yeah, and I like to explore dance on camera and how different camera angles can kind of transform dance. And I'm just curious. Like, I'm a curious person, and I find personally dance itself alone is really boring. I like having cinematic elements to dance. I like having like when I go in to a studio and I dance, I need to be wearing like a dress or a suit. Like I have to be wearing something that takes me out of like proper dance space and puts me into like a different context, I guess. I don't
know
if that
makes
sense.
It feels like a merging of like dancer and artist, whereas like as you were saying with the mannequin, like I feel like that's such a thing that's like endemic to like the school system, but then when you come into your professional life, you can actually like have control over what you're doing, at least in your case, which is really interesting.
Like, and I think that's just because maybe I went through so much trauma in dance space that I need to find a way to dance without feeling like I'm in a dance space. I'll often try and find non-studio spaces to dance in because I feel more free in those spaces.
Oh, interesting. Like what kind of spaces?
Like photo studios. Or like just like open spaces that are clean. And but yeah, like the minute I'm in a dance studio and I see a bar on a mirror, I'm like, I can't be here.
And in relation to the idea of community, like another respondent talked about the way that competition dance, or like comp as you call it, really honed into dancers the mantra of you're only really competing against yourself. And you just touched on this, which they said it kind of alienated them from their peers because it created this like hyper competitive environment, which like, of course, comp, it's an actual competition, you are competing, but it kind of takes the camaraderie out of that competition that should be valued or emphasized, especially among like young people. Like, of course you can be competing, but it's like, it should be fun. And they said, I think this process parallels that of all women on the internet. We are always told that we should not compare ourselves to others, but are then put in spaces where we are structured to be in a constant state of comparison, yet paralysis almost. So in a way, it almost feels as if dance videos on the internet go hand in hand with this putrid necessity to reach perfection in both spaces, the dance world and the internet as a whole. So eloquent. All of these people are so well-spoken. But yeah, basically they reference this viral video. Maybe this is one of the viral videos you saw, but it's of this 10-year-old dancer named Sofia Lucia. It circulated back in 2012, but basically it's this little girl. She's 10 years old and she does 40 pirouettes in a row. And like, obviously she's the exception. Like she broke the world record and then did like 55 turns the next year. But this person explained that this video was like less so inspiring than it was daunting for them. And that it made them feel kind of the sense of hopelessness and like envy. And you see so many videos like that online today, like all over social media, with these dancers completing these insane moves. And Susanna talked about that. Do you think the increased visibility of dance on the internet with these kind of like viral dance videos has added to a feeling of competition among dancers? Like, have you spoken to younger dancers, or do you know how they're feeling about this?
I kind of feel like I've been out of the dance community for a while, but I definitely know what that feeling is like, because growing up, it was always like, who had their leg up the highest? Whose split was, you know, the craziest? And it kind of is similar to like how many turns you can do. It feels like dance is less of an art form and it's more of like an acrobatic, like it's a acrobatics basically, where it's like who can do the most or who can do the craziest tricks. And it's like that was never what dance was for me. But like there are these shows like Dance World or something. It's like So You Think You Can Dance, but it's like the new form of it. And it's just like dancers doing trick after trick after trick after trick. And I'm like, this is not what dance is, but it feels like because it's kind of thrilling to watch, like, whoa, that person can do that many turns. I didn't know that was possible. It makes it more accessible for people to watch who don't know anything about dance, right? Yeah. Because like when you're watching contemporary dance, it can be like, I think really jarring for someone who doesn't know anything about dance versus like if people are just doing a bunch of tricks, it's like, whoa, this is crazy. This is really cool.
It's like spectacle driven.
Yeah, it's spectacle driven. It's not actually about the art form and like what it's expressing then. So I think for people who are like, I just do dance because I need to express myself and I'm not doing it to do a bunch of turns, when they see that, it's like, well, then maybe I'm not a good dancer and I need to do like 10 turns or I need my leg to be higher in order to be good at this. But it's like, that's not true at all. You can be a brilliant dancer and do none of that. And that's kind of also a part of my practice is I grew up an acrobat and then I ended up rejecting acrobatics because I thought it was a gimmick. Like personally, I was like, how can I make dance interesting without doing any tricks? I even went to like the circus school in Montreal because I wanted to be in Cirque du Soleil for a little bit. And then after doing that program, I was like, I actually don't like this because it's about just doing poses.
Yeah.
And I want to find a way to communicate something without needing to rely on like spectacle and like tricks and like.
Yeah. I always felt the part of dance that I found most gratifying growing up was like the acting part of it, because I also loved acting. So it was any of the part where you had to embody a character. Like I really loved that. And I think that was like, even watching So You Think You Can Dance, like that was the part I loved the most. And like the people I loved the most were the ones who were able to kind of like express something through dance, through kind of like acting in a way, or genuine like feeling.
Dance theater is a big thing, and it's a big thing that I'm inspired by. There's a choreographer, Pina Bausch, and she only does like dance theater, and it's all just like gestures, and they don't do any crazy tricks or partner work. It's all just like conveying emotion, and it's like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
But yeah, the respondents expressed a general fatigue with social media, like both in the way dance had become so pervasive on it and in the way that it's become this necessary evil. People talked about the way that it made dancing feel like a 2D thing that was made to be viewed through a screen rather than this like engaging, dynamic form of expression. So if we think about performance art and the way you consume it, like it's a very 3D, almost 4D experience. Like sometimes it's interactive. People are standing around the performance artist. Like it's not, it has less of that kind of like stage aspect to it. It's often in these like more dynamic spaces, I would say. And so I think that's why they're leaning towards this. But dance itself is also this kind of like, it is in itself a performance art. It's a type of performing art. You go and watch it in person. So someone said that like the way that it's put online kind of takes the nuance and like the context out of dance that makes it so interesting to them.
Well, also going back to what you and Sarah were talking about in the Hamilton episode, and something that like, you know, I've thought a lot about just in terms of, you know, my experience with theater is that I remember you were saying that, talking about the difference between acting for camera and acting on stage, and it's just like they're not the same thing at all. And when you are performing and when you're watching a live performance even, there's an energy there that just is lost in the recorded video. And I think it would only make sense that that would extend also to dance.
Of course, yeah. I think it's something that plagues like all the performing arts in every way, yeah. The way that it's consumed is so specific and site-specific and energy-specific, I guess. So ultimately, my takeaway is that like that classic scenario where we aren't sure what is influencing what, like whether it's the wider culture kind of creeping into dance or whether dance is creeping into the wider culture, which one do you think it is?
I think that the values of a certain kind of dance. Like, ballet isn't the type of dance that's popular on social media per se. Like, not the number one, right?
Yeah, no.
That's TikTok dances. But I think what's kind of resurging from ballet is maybe perhaps a bit less connected to that and more connected to the sort of traditional values that we imagine being associated with ballet and how they're now becoming relevant in a time where the standards for women are shifting back into like this much more submissive place than they were perhaps 5 years ago, which is also when I think ballet was going through its own renaissance in trying to move away from this like traditionalism. So I would say like perhaps it's hand in hand. Perhaps, you know, if we as the culture are accepting this more traditional form of ballet, then ballet can kind of sneakily revert back to that. But I don't know. I think they're always mirroring each other, especially right now that it's in fashion.
Well, it's interesting even thinking about when ballet specifically starts coming into the wider culture, like you were talking about Y2K and the 2000s and like ballet flats being such a big thing back then, as well as skinniness. And it's like, well, what happened during the 2000s? Also a recession. You know what I mean? So it's like you already had this wider culture of skinniness, ballet is coming in, and then you have a recession. And I was reading a lot about how during the Great Depression, ballet flats were also a huge trend because they were a lot cheaper than other shoes. Or it was either the Great Depression or one of the World Wars. I think maybe World War II, where the type of material used to make ballet shoes because of rations, it made them more prominent during that time. So it's like, yeah, when ballet is entering the culture more, it feels actually kind of pointed almost, which I think is kind of fascinating. And same as right now, we're in a recession right now.
Ballet is one of the most kind of regimented, intense hobbies that like women or, you know, or trends that like women are subjected to. And I do think that like it does speak a lot about like what is going on with women in a greater sense.
I think if you're taking an art form with like roots so tied up in traditional femininity, especially with ballet, and you pair that with like our surveillance society and like social media panopticon already, where everyone's constantly checking and like regulating themselves, you're gonna see a lot of the flaws of that art form become like enhanced. And, you know, they were always there, but now that everything is, like, out in the open online, it's more clear than it ever was before.
We're in that ballet studio of mirrors.
Literally.
Mm-hmm.